Hello and welcome to AstroTalk UK. AT UK is a not-for-profit 30-minute weekly audio podcast primarily for and by amateur astronomers in the UK. Available only online, AT UK is a virtual meeting point for the amateur astronomy community. Each episode is an MP3 file which can be downloaded automatically with a free subscription via one of the many podcast readers. I use iTunes. My name is Gurbir Singh, and I host AT UK. I am not a scientist, nor am I an astronomer. Topics of discussion have no fixed boundaries other than their relevance to amateur astronomy. Each week's episode consists of pre-recorded conversations with individuals discussing their roles, lives and achievements of amateur astronomers and their hobby. More about AT UK at www.astrotalkuk.org. If you have a topic for discussion, drop me a note on info@astrotalkuk.org. AstroTalk UK, amateur astronomy, expert opinion. Episode 12, Sunday, April the 20th, 2008. Next year marks the 40th anniversary of Apollo 11 landing in the Sea of Tranquility on the Moon. In today's episode, filmmaker Chris Riley talks about the film In the Shadow of the Moon and astronaut Buzz Aldrin on his interest in astronomy. You may have heard, or perhaps have already seen, the recently released film In the Shadow of the Moon. It is the human story behind the Apollo program, told without narration by those astronauts who travelled to the moon. The DVD was released at the end of March 2008. Dr. Chris Riley, co-producer and assistant director for In the Shadow of the Moon. For those who have not seen it yet, Chris, and it has nothing to do with a total solar eclipse, of course, briefly, what is the film about?
No, it's not about an eclipse. Shadow of the Moon is a film about the Apollo astronauts and their experiences pretty much right from childhood all the way through to today, with, of course, the main focus of the film being about that sort of heady decade of the 1960s and even into the early 70s that made them all such key figures in history, I suppose, with their flights to the moon. But it's more than just about them. It's more than just about the moon and about Apollo. I think it's probably of interest to anybody who's who lives on Earth.
You're an author, a journalist, a broadcaster, as well as a filmmaker. I think most people will know about your award-winning film, Space Odyssey, Voyage to the Planets. I saw that. That was terrific. You did a really good job there. Thank you.
Thanks.
What was your motivation for this film? Was it the moon itself or the human story in its exploration?
I think we've always been more interested, I suppose, in the human stories of exploring it. I think there's something very powerful, about seeing a human being inside one of these remarkable sort of spacesuits that were developed specially for Apollo, standing there on another world and looking back at the Earth. And however many robotic missions, you know, went before them and have gone further after them, the moon, you know, wonderful as it is, came second, I guess.
As a kid, you must have had an interest in astronomy?
Oh, yes, I did. I mean, my father was a bit of a sort of a Victorian scientist, not that he was that old, but he just had this really eclectic sort of love of everything, you know, and every bit of natural history. He'd collect rocks and fossils, and, you know, I actually went on to study geology first rather than astronomy. But he would also take me out into the back garden and point out the planets in the night sky and, of course, the moon. And he got a pair of bird-watching binoculars that were too big for me to hold, but he'd hold them as steadily as he could, and I'd get a view of the craters on the moon. And of course, if he could hold them really steady, I sometimes even glimpsed Saturn's ring.
And do you do some of that today?
Yeah, I've never really lost that sense of wonder. I mean, I whenever Jupiter or Venus, of course, which are the two sort of easiest planets to see, are in the sky, I can't help but point them out to people, whoever I'm with, and say, you know, That's Jupiter. That's half a billion miles away. And look, there's the Galilean moons. If only we could see them just out of sight, of course, of the human eye. I did sell my telescope. Actually, I used to have a Meade. I traded it in for a better digital camera with a good lens. Actually, I've done a bit more astrophotography with that than I ever did with the telescope. So I guess I still dabble, but I'm a total amateur.
Back to the film In the Shadow of the Moon was released on DVD in the UK at the end of last month. How long has it been in the making? How long have you been associated with it?
You know, Gabir, it sometimes feels like we've actually worked on Apollo ourselves. The engineers, you know, they pulled it off in sort of 8 years, and it didn't quite take us that long. But when I look back at how long I've been sort of working in this sort of area of this subject area with films, it sometimes does feel like about as long as that. Well, to answer your question, I mean, Shadow, we had our first conversation about film in 2004, I guess, actually, while we were still working on Space Odyssey. Space Odyssey was put together by the team that had made Walking with Dinosaurs, and I was brought in to produce it and sort of essentially, you know, shape and steer the science, because I had that background knowledge. But we were very lucky in tempting Apollo 15 astronaut Dave Scott to come and work as a technical advisor on the series. Now, Dave had worked previously on Apollo 13 with Tom Hanks, and then on the HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon, and he was kind of interested in the film business. And when I tracked him down, he was actually living in London at the time, and so not far from where we were producing this series. And he was interested in coming along, so he'd come along to the studios at Pinewood where we were filming it, and help advise the actors on sort of the jargon and the sort of technobabble that they'd speak as they were making descents or ascents from the surfaces of various sort of moons and other planets that we visited in the series. And I think he enjoyed it. But towards the end of the series, he called me up and said, look, he had this other project in mind, I guess. And it was to do with Apollo and to do with sort of documenting it properly. And that's what sort of Shadow came out of. And so that conversation was 2004. And what are we now, as the DVDs just come out, 2008. So essentially sort of 4 years, of which probably 2 years of that was quite full time. And the other 2 years was very bitty as we were getting the funding in place and getting the astronauts on board.
You were able to get quite a lot of new footage for this film.
This was an archive that I'd worked with on and off for about 10 years, actually, since I'd started working on The Planets for BBC Two back in the late 1990s. And I knew that NASA had filmed almost everything they did between sort of the late 1950s and even into the mid-70s, I suppose, on 16mm film. They kept it all, which so there were two miracles there, really. First, that somebody had the foresight to film a lot of this stuff. And secondly, that later generations working there hadn't just thrown it away, because there was a big sort of move to chuck away film in the 1970s when videotape was starting to come in. Uh-huh. But thankfully, those who'd kind of kept and curated this collection had preserved it very well. So there were some 10,000 rolls of 16mm film that we wanted to look through in finding material to make this film. Now, that 10,000 rolls of film was all the stuff that was shot on the ground, essentially. It was engineering footage, so it covered everything from, you know, tiny tests of new materials through to the launch of the Saturn V. In addition to that, then, there were some 20 hours of light film, 16mm film as well, that had been flown on missions on Mercury, on Gemini, and of course on Apollo all the way to the moon, and then shot on the moon's surface. And this material was a lot more precious, of course. That was never going to have been thrown away. But it had been kept under liquid nitrogen in cold storage in some vaults at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, outside of Houston, for all these decades, and only removed a handful of times over those sort of 40 years to be transferred onto the latest state-of-the-art videotape, which in the 1970s wasn't very good and has got better as the years have passed. So that stuff was all very, very well preserved. And actually, what most of us were used to seeing in various Apollo documentaries and films over the years was that first time it had been transferred onto tape in the 70s and then copied and copied and copied. And it was a bit fuzzy, not very clear. And that's sort of the picture of Apollo most of us had in our heads. Just as we were getting to work on this film then, we HD, high definition digital tape, was just coming in, and NASA took the film out of cold storage one more time and put it onto HD tape. And we were the first documentary team to get our hands on this stuff and use it. So it was a sort of twofold thing, this really pristine, lovely onboard flight film that we were being able to use for the first time in HD format, and then also this sort of body of 10,000 rolls of film shot on the ground. So it was a kind of mixture, very, very rich archive, and I was very pleased that I'd been a diligent student of their film archives over this last decade, because I was able to tap into it quite effectively.
You managed to get pretty much all the astronauts who were able to participate, with the exception of Neil Armstrong.
Our intention, right the way from the beginning of this project, was to get at least one person from every crew that went to the moon. So there were 9 flights to the moon, get at least one person from each of those missions, which we more than did. We managed to entice every living moonwalker to appear in the film, except, as you point out, Neil Armstrong. That wasn't through want of trying. I mean, we felt when we were trying to get the project off the ground that there was a pretty good chance of being able to attract Neil, because we had these close connections to him through the other astronauts. And we were in email contact with him. I mean, he was interested in our project and as supportive as he felt he could be. He didn't want to sort of sacrifice the thought of his face appearing on cinema screens across America. What wasn't very attractive to him, largely because when he came back from the moon in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, his life was made pretty miserable by the world's press and the world's sort of busybodies trying to sort of get a piece of him, as it were. Mm-hmm. And so, that effect was continued to plague him throughout his life. And it's only in his sort of older years that he's been able to sort of claw back a bit of that anonymity that he treasures so much. And the thought of sort of reversing that was really not appealing. And we were all told, look, if you keep on at Neil, he will eventually sort of agree to take part. But we felt that wasn't fair. You know, that was his decision, and we should respect that. And so we stopped and backed off, really. And I think what it did do, paradoxically, was to create a film that said more about him than if he'd actually been in it, because it allowed his colleagues to all be very honest and frank about him and who he was, what sort of a man he was, and what his place in history meant. Whereas if he'd been in it, it would have been more embarrassing and awkward for them to be talking about him. And him being quite a modest man, I don't think he'd have been very revealing or interested in talking about himself so much. So actually, as a producer of the film, I was quite happy with the way it turned out.
How is In the Shadow of the Moon different from For All Mankind?
Well, I was always a big fan of For All Mankind. It was and still is, a really definitive film about that period. And the filmmakers who made For All Mankind, of course, did a similar job to us in trawling the NASA archives for film. In those days, they transferred it all onto 35mm film rather than high-definition digital media. But the results were similarly stunning. It was the main difference, though, of course, is that in For All Mankind, you never see any of the astronauts as they are today talking. The interviews were all collected over several years on audio tape, and so you just hear the audio sort of flickering in over the pictures. And there's something very magical about that in some ways, in that you just see them as they were. But I think there's something also equally fascinating in seeing, in our film, them as they are now, intercut and often with split screen, with the archive as they were then in the past. And you can see, particularly even in the very early part of the film, where we found this lovely bit of archive of John Young, which I tracked down up at Edwards Air Force Base, when he was a test pilot. He's sort of got his helmet on, he sort of looks up and then looks down and looks up and looks down again and sort of flickers his eyes. And that was very skillfully intercut by our editor with a very similar sort of tick that he has today, mm-hmm. where he kind of looked up and looked down at the camera as we were filming him. And I thought there was some wonderful sort of echoes across the decades of how these men were and how they are today.
I've seen the film and I was quite touched by the honest and sincere nature of some of the comments, and in parts it was really funny, but it really brought the human element across. I thought it was very well done.
Thank you.
Finally, Chris, what other astronomy-related projects are you working on at the moment?
Well, so off the back of Shadow of the Moon, we've set up an online archive called Footage Vault, all one word. We're trying to make a lot of this material more widely accessible, mostly to the kind of the broadcast industry, so that they can browse the collection online and download clips to use in future documentaries. You know, the film Shadow was only 100 minutes long, and having looked through all sort of 10,000 rolls of film at the Johnson Space Center, we were really sure there was another TV series to be done, a bigger. And so we've been lucky enough to get a commission from the Discovery Channel over in the States to make a series which we're just putting the finishing touches to. It's taken another year, the last year, called Moon Machines, which is essentially the story of the 400,000 engineers and scientists who put those lucky 12 Americans on the surface of the moon. There's one on the command module, the lunar module, the guidance computer, which is a fascinating story in itself, done by folks at MIT and the instrumentation lab there. The spacesuits, of course, another great, great story of engineering challenge. And finally, the rover, which I've just started working on this week. So that's six sort of one-hour films for the Discovery Channel about each of these incredible elements that these engineers put together to get us to the moon. So that's the next project, which should be airing on the Discovery Channel in July this year.
Dr. Chris Riley, thank you very much indeed.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for your interest.
For most of us city dwellers, the night sky is restricted. Clouds, streetlights, high-rise buildings, security lighting, air pollution from factories and car exhausts. On good nights with naked eyes, you may be able to see hundreds of objects. A question for you. On a bad night, say a visual zenith magnitude of 2 or 3, how many objects can you see? Hundreds? Or perhaps just a few? Imagine now, you travel to somewhere with no light pollution, no obscuration of the skyline, and not a cloud in the sky. How many objects can you see now? Just 2. Buzz Aldrin, who did just that in July 1969, said the Earth and the Sun were the only objects he could see in the sky from the surface of the moon. I spoke to Buzz, I did ask, that's how he prefers to be addressed, during his recent trip to Pontefract, another successful program arranged by Ken Willoughby at West Yorkshire Astronomical Society, as discussed in episode 7. Before we started proper, Buzz talks about his scholarship application, which fortunately he was unsuccessful with.
Well, I was given the opportunity to try for a Rhodes Scholars back in, 1950, right. And then again in 1952,
right.
And but I wasn't successful. And my life would have obviously been quite a bit different had I, as an Air Force officer at West Point, come over here to Oxford. I wouldn't have had the experiences of combat in Korea in 1953 during the Korean War.
Yeah.
And I very much appreciated that experience of being a military person and being exposed to the experiences of combat. It's a very stimulating and very
and very dangerous.
Well, yes, it is. But it's what we're trained to do.
Yes.
And you
must be the most interviewed man on the planet. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I haven't given a lot of thought, but I'm sure I'm not the most interesting person at all.
One off.
You know, we have these campaigns for a political office for the presidency, and those people are being interviewed all the time, continuous. I really feel sorry for them because they don't have much time in between to have privacy, and the demands on that kind of an office are just... really kind of brutal in terms of your private life.
Yeah, well, I've seen you on TV so many times. You have a wonderful sense of humor. You always come across very friendly. As a kid, as a youngster, did you ever have an interest in astronomy?
I can't say. I was following the things that were evolving, but I was more interested in being a part of an operator, a pilot in the air, than I was in looking out into the stars in the sky.
You never had a telescope as a youngster, or?
No, I never did.
So when was that?
But I do remember. I may have been 7, 8 years old, that I was walking at night and I saw the Aurora Borealis.
Wow.
And after a while I thought, well, gee, I guess you see that every night, don't you? And no, you don't.
Surely that wasn't from New Jersey, was it?
Yes, it was.
Wow. Yeah. It doesn't come down.
No, it must have been quite a storm.
Do you remember much of what the stars and the sky looked like from either one of your EBAs or en route to the moon?
It strikes me, without trying to actually compare the intensity of the star background, that I've been able to see more stars on clear nights, maybe in Texas and maybe in Hawaii, than even a moon less night in space, because there's ultraviolet protection in the visors that we have, and there's also in the windscreen, in the windows. but most of the time, there's other lights that are affecting your ability to see things.
So it must have been difficult to see this much in the sky whilst you were on the moon as well.
Well, it's impossible to see anything except the Earth and the Sun. If we had a telescope on the surface of the Moon, it was an alignment telescope, and when you look through it, it shielded the light being reflected from the surface as it was pointed up, and it, of course, kept the light coming from the Earth or coming from the Sun. The Sun was behind us, and the Earth was a little bit behind us too.
Right. I just thought, you know, you'd have a clear sky, but obviously all the protection, which was essential, of course. When did you want to become an astronaut?
Well, I'm a practical person. I try not to wish for things that aren't within the realm of possibility.
Yeah.
And I just early on wanted to fly airplanes, and then when it became closer, clearly the excitement and the challenges of being a fighter pilot, as I was going through pilot training, the Korean War was starting and developing, and so I was able to get into that conflict for about the last 6 months of the war, shot down a couple of airplanes.
Yeah.
And then served in other capacities with higher capacity and higher performance spacecraft, supersonic F-100s, and we transitioned over from patrolling the border to nuclear weapon delivery, and for a young pilot in his 20s to have the responsibility, in case the war begins, of delivering a nuclear weapon on some target in Eastern Europe is quite a a challenge.
In your PhD thesis that you did, the line of sight guidance techniques for manned orbital rendezvous, you dedicated a thesis to the people and the crew of the present and future manned space programs.
Sure.
You expressed an interest there, I think, in joining the space program.
Well, I knew at the time that I did not have the qualifications. I had not gone through test pilot training. Yeah. I chose instead the time-consuming task of getting a doctor's degree at MIT. Yeah. And I felt that perhaps there was some aftermath of a fairly serious case of hepatitis that I had had a couple of years earlier, that might eliminate chances for test pilot training. And as it turned out, it was a little bit of a challenge passing the NASA physical. But I felt that for the second group that I would apply anyway, even though it wasn't qualified, just to let them know what they were missing. I didn't really expect that they were going to say, oh, we're going to change the rules just for you, you know. But they did change the rules the next year. But nobody would really admit that it was because of my application. They just felt that they were going to expand it a little bit. But you didn't have to have test pilot training for the third group. So there were three of us that were picked that I think were not actually trained test pilots.
Back in 2002, is it true you whacked a guy because he... you have in your country, as we do have in our country, these conspiracy theorists. Is it true?
It's not one of my astronomical achievements, but it was one of those really spur of the moment. The person had been bothering quite a few of the other astronauts, and it was the second encounter that I had with him, and I just sort of lost my cool, and it turned out that it was very good publicity. I don't think it stopped him or changed his mind, because he was interested in getting the publicity of that.
I saw the film In the Shadow of the Moon day before yesterday. I take it you've seen the end product?
Oh, yes, many times, yeah.
What do you think? Did it accurately represent the manned program to the moon?
It is. It's educational to hear the people explain things in ordinary language. It's not exactly educational informing as far as the precise reasons that we do things. It's an example of the human relating to other humans what the experiences might be like and the different things that they went through. But I think the public that are responsible for paying the expenses of future exploration need more than entertainment from astronauts. They need the significant explanations of what the real benefits are internationally and scientifically.
Thank you very much indeed for your time. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to AstroTalk UK. ATUK is a non-profit project produced and recorded by Gurbir Singh. He nor any of the participants are paid for their contribution. ATUK's content is not validated against any authoritative source, and all the views and opinions are held by those who choose to express them. If you have a topic of interest you would like to discuss on ATUK, drop me a note, info@astrotalkuk.org.